At Giant Eagle, you may have spotted the Stacker. With uncanny My Perks ability, she stacks up the perks to choose either dollars off or up to 20% off her entire grocery bill. The Stacker, stacking up huge savings with My Perks. Find your My Perksonality and transform your shopping into free gas and groceries. Full details at GiantEagle.com/MyPerks. Perks cannot be earned or redeemed on select items. Restrictions apply.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm a bit nostalgic for an era of the internet where cultural criticism was a little more blunt. It feels like a lot of critics are holding back. Today on the podcast, a new project trying to put a little more bite into culture writing, and also what we lose when critics get too polite. I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Look, there was a time when the most feared culture critics had the sharpest takes. They'd give you the most biting one-liners, these takedowns of a failed piece of art. You might even say these takedowns were, like, a little mean. Delia Kai misses that kind of criticism, so she started this pop-up blog called Hate Read, and that's where critics write about things that they hate. They hate the thing and they write about it. But here's the thing. They do it anonymously with no fear of retribution. I think her project raises a lot of interesting questions about where culture criticism is at. So I talked to Delia about why she started it. And Nico Stratus, one of our favorite culture critics, was there to weigh in on this experiment. I started by asking Delia to describe the era of mean culture critics that inspired Hate Read.
I think, like, everyone who sort of maybe missed the peak of it and has mostly almost, like, heard about it more in these sort of romantic terms of, like, oh, man, you guys don't remember when Gawker used to run the internet and everyone just woke up in a cold sweat, you know? So I think like, kind of coming up in media in sort of this post-Gawker era, that was just sort of the shining beacon of, like, what maybe we all – were taught that, like, the peak internet, peak sort of, like, digital media, the Wild West days were like.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, you can't help but kind of buying into that romanticism a little bit of just, like, wow, people just walked around and said anything they wanted, for good and for worse, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think now everyone is a bit, like, the internet is both smaller and bigger. And so I think just this yearning for kind of a you know, maybe like a bygone era, it definitely influences everything we do now.
Yeah, there's something really striking to me about the Gawker era, because, like, when you try to describe it to people, you also have to give the background context of, like, this is an era when, like, media was a little bit less corporatized, a little bit less formal than it is now. And so the young people felt the freedom and the possibility to engage with art and go, like, I kind of really hated that, and I'm going to write a short blog about it to let people know that I hated it. And then people could respond accordingly. And maybe you agreed, maybe you didn't agree, but the point was that it didn't feel restrained. It kind of felt like you could just say whatever is on your mind, and there was no real limitation to the way that you engage with art. Can you give an example of a Hate Read right now that you're putting together that embodies this past era, something that captures this sort of, I guess, tone of commentary?
I mean, can I talk about one that's already come out?
Yeah. You want to talk about one that maybe got the internet a little mad at you from this week? Okay, go ahead.
So earlier this week, we published an essay from a young media writer just about how much she hates media parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she sort of, like, shows her hand a little bit. She's like, you know, I came up sort of, you know, looking at what everyone was posting on Instagram stories and thinking that all these parties sounded so cool and they look so cool. And she's like, you know, then I started going to them and I realized that they're really boring and that, you know, media people are really just, like, kind of not fun. And it turns out everyone just talks about work.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of very funny because she really roasts, I think, a lot of maybe, like, caricatures about the industry.
Yeah.
But I think at the heart of it, there is this sort of, like, this kernel of, like, real disenchantment. And I think it resonates because I think it reflects what a lot of people, you know, what I certainly thought, like, you know, working in New York media was going to be like, it's just overall less sexy than you would ever want it to be.
That's not what I was promised when I was watching Sex and the City, but I appreciate that this point of view. But I think, like, this is a little bit of what it's chafing against. Nico, your initial reaction to the idea of Hate Read, I want to get into, like, your thoughts about it now a little bit later. But first, Let's talk about how your initial reaction wasn't so positive. Why? What was going on there? Being like, hearing about this and going, I don't know about this.
I think I was surprised at my own softness. Like, as a person, I am a person that makes things. I know, it's funny. I'm wearing a cardigan today, and this is all sort of ties into, if you saw the thing, the Ringer went and found the drummer from Jet to talk to him about the famous Pitchfork review where they just posted a photo of a monkey peeing into his own mouth as a review of the record. And
which was really mean. Yes. Okay.
It's really mean. And he was talking about Phoebe Bridgers, and he was like, I guess you would like it if you like cardigans, which is such a funny thing to like point out to, because also like, cardigans are fine, man. But anyways, I have this, like, I'm a person who makes things, and like, there is sometimes, and I get defensive about like, if people are going to be mean, they're going to be mean to a thing that I made. And there's like a defensiveness.
Yeah.
So like, when I first read about it, it's funny, because now I'm like, now I'm being confronted, because the person that made the thing is like, is on the call with me. The call is coming from inside the house. She's looking me in the eyes as I talk about this. But I thought about it for a second, and I was like, oh man, this is like, we need this so desperately. Like, we actually do. Because like, look, I've written about Taylor Swift before. I know what it's like when you're like nice but not like fawning.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, well, I guess I have to consider moving. And look, I'm a trans person. I'm used to changing my name, but I don't want to have to do it a third time just because I wrote about a Taylor Swift album. You know what I mean? So there's like, there is this desire to be like, I also want to be able to be critical in a way that is maybe like finds the line and then sees just how far over it I want to go in a way that isn't going to like hurt my future chances at employment in this like very fraught and difficult industry.
I mean, I think this is the thing I want to pick up on, Delia. Like, this idea that Nico just laid out, this idea that like we have gotten, you know, more and more constrained in our ability to critique. I'm wondering if you can pinpoint for you the moment where cultural criticism seemed to have softened. When was that moment for you? When, as you sort of observe the trajectory of criticism?
I'm trying to think if there was one moment. I mean, I just remember there's a point where it felt like press tour Twitter had taken over, where, you know, it just felt like I just remember vividly the day when the Don't Worry Darling crew was like in Venice, and there was that whole like, did Harry Styles like spit on Chris Pine,
or did he not? Yes.
Yeah. And it just seems so sort of like a symptom of how starved people were for like wanting a little bit of conflict, wanting to like pull something apart and analyze it and dissect it. But it's like, this is like a promotional tour for a movie that we're not even talking about like the piece of art itself.
Yeah.
Again, this is a very maybe like utopian view, but I was like, we used to argue about books. And now, you know, we just want to.
We used to be a society.
Styles is the thing or not. Yeah.
Nico, for me, I think it's got to be the moment. I mean, you mentioned Taylor Swift, so we're just going to do it. You know, she has a song called Mean, and the song is about the critic and cultural commentator who's still alive, Bob Lefsetz. He now has a newsletter, you know, where he talks about the music industry. But she wrote this song that was kind of like a pushback against, you know, that very thing, the idea of he can criticize her voice and he can criticize how she, you know, appears on her album. But she just kind of feels like he's mean, and there's a meanness to his critique that is like not okay. When you think of criticism and how it's made the shift to this like different place where we maybe do pull our punches in ways that Bob Lefsetz did not feel like he needed to pull his punches. When do you think we started making that shift and criticism started being a little too mindful of the people on the internet who are going to get a little mad if you're not fawning over their artist?
We have always had people in culture that are like sort of the dominant figures of an era. Like, this is a thing that has happened for time immemorial, you know, but it sort of seems like, you know, there was a thing in the day about how like Taylor Swift is like a new billionaire now, which congratulations, great year for rich people was the headline, which I'm still thinking about. But this idea of like pop stars are tied to capital. Capital is tied to websites. You know, it's tied to clicks. It's tied to all these things. The teeth started to be ground away in favor of ensuring access to that same shared capital. And like, and the more that happens, you know, I think a lot about the Beyonce press tour right now and the PR tour, because there was a thing about how like, oh, her team got the, I know. Yeah, you got right up to the camera.
I'm getting real close to the camera. Like, are you about to say a bad word about Beyonce? I'm joking. Continue. Talk your talk.
But it is an interesting thing, because there was an article about like how her team organized and got her record into the pressing plant. Like, is it that her team organized, or is that she's Beyonce and she can call a record pressing plant and say, hey, I'm surprised dropping a record and you're going to press it immediately? And they said, yes, because she is one of the richest people in the world.
Right.
And it's just like, the media around that and the conversation around that and the article around that isn't having that conversation because it doesn't want to be too toothy in case it loses access to that conversation.
Yeah.
Because this is the thing that drives clicks to these websites, the four websites we have left, you know. There is also, like, it's funny thinking about the Gawker thing, because at a certain point, people are only going to know Hulk Hogan as the guy that shut down a website,
right,
as opposed to, like, a guy that used to fight for different reasons. And, you know, we used to be a proper society where, like, we could have these sort of public entanglements. But now, because we've tied everything to so much capital, it is harder than ever to have critical conversations about people who are, like, in the upper crust of, you know, financial society, let's say.
The very existence of Hate Read is making an argument that we lose something when we take away the meanness of cultural criticism. We lose something when we say, this is generally the territory you can play in and you can't really, like, push beyond that. What do you think we lose when we take away the meanness in criticism?
I mean, it's almost like sort of just like capping just the experience of human emotion, you know, because I think like if you hate, like, you know, an album or, you know, a cultural work, if you hate it with a passion, like, you're passionate about it. And I think that's as interesting to me if someone really despises this TV show and hear all these reasons, versus if someone really loves one, and, you know, then I want to know that too. So I think it's almost, it kind of like blunts the sort of range of emotions maybe you're like ever allowed to feel, or like you're ever allowed to feel about culture, which I think is like, that's so sad. That's the whole point. That's why we're here, right?
Nico, the scale of how you feel about Taylor Swift can only go from absolutely love to, yeah, she's all right. You cannot go anywhere below that. That is what Delia is saying here. But Nico, what do you think about this? What do you think about this idea of blunting human emotion as a consequence of losing meanness in cultural criticism?
I mean, I think that's true. You know, it is like you are sort of putting boxes around how much you are allowed to express in your relationship to a thing. I mean, cultural criticism and is taking a piece of culture and putting it in context in the world around it and having a conversation. And if you have to hold yourself back on being too mean, we're using the word mean a lot, but really what you're doing is being critical. And sometimes being critical veers into territory that some people might brush up against, just as I did when I first read about the idea. And that's the thing. We should be sort of forced into these zones where we feel a little bit uncomfortable when somebody is being critical of a thing, because it forces us to feel a different emotion, which is important, and B, question why we're feeling that different emotion and have a conversation about that. You know, every time The Cut publishes a personal essay, we have 2 days of discourse about it. And no one really wants to talk about the fact that they love having that discourse about it, because it causes us to think and feel and have a conversation. And we've kind of fallen away from that world in favor of, you know, always having the fawning reviews. We do sort of need to see the line and walk over it, because I think once we're over it, that's where we're going to have a real conversation about a thing.
Mm-hmm. I would say also, we are in this precarious time in media. There have been these waves of layoffs across Canada and the US, which means a lot of critics have to do this work as freelancers. Maybe, Nico, I'll go to you. You're a freelance critic. What kind of vulnerability do you think that opens up in terms of critics who have to do this work, but they also have to do it as freelancers? They're just not as secure in their employment.
I mean, look, I'm a 41-year-old sober trans woman. I'm not exactly the most well-represented demographic in media as it is. And like, if I'm really critical of a thing, it makes me worry that I'm not going to get, you know, more work, or that people are going to pay less attention to me or whatever. Like, there is a social capital tied to your opinion of these massive pieces of culture. And for a lot of culture critics that are more freelance than ever, especially people that live in marginalized, or that are from marginalized communities, you know, it is a harder than ever thing to be critical of the darlings of pop culture, whatever they may be. And it really does, like, you know, we not only need to hear people that don't like a thing, we need to know where they're coming from, you know, because everybody's going to have a different inroad. We talk about this, like, meanness and the critical, you know, there is a race and gender and, you know, class conversation that are all inherently tied into this as well. Is like, where is your approach coming from?
If we're trying to get back, Delia, to a place where, you know, there's still honest, maybe meaner criticism, is doing it anonymously the answer? Because you've provided the space in Hate Read for people to come out and go, like, give me the thing that you hate, just lay it on me, you know, go all guns blazing. But also you can call yourself Dicki Minaj and hide behind, well, first of all, I want to know who that is right now. But more importantly, I think, like, why anonymously? Why is that the approach?
I've been thinking about this project as a bit of a social experiment, because I wanted to see, like, what would people write about if they have anonymity, but also what will people say if they know that the writer, there's no like kind of real person to pin their critique on. Mm-hmm. So I, because someone was sort of like, oh, it's interesting how that anonymity protects people both ways, because if you find out who, you know, this writer is, then you can't be out here tweeting like this writing is terrible because you know they're going to see it. So it's kind of, I think that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But I don't think this would be, I wouldn't want this to be like an on-running, like, you know, anything that isn't a pop-up, because I think that's the experiment that's sort of fun. I think in a, you know, in a better world, we sort of understand that like criticism is not an attack, you know, in the same way that, you know, how people are like, oh, conflict is not abuse. It's sort of like, we should all just like sign an agreement that's like, yes, we can say stuff about each other's work. Mm-hmm. And then we can go, you know, to drinks and like look each other in the eye and just be like, okay, you know, I respect that you didn't like it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I'm like, I don't think this could last forever, but I do sort of like the general paranoia it kind of injects, because now everyone's like, well, who is it? Is it someone I know? You know, is it, do people walk among us, you know, with this thought? So I like that as just a very temporary thing.
I see that you're not going to name names and I hate it. Thank you. Delia, you've been, okay, so the pop-up has been live for a week. What have you learned in the week that Hate Read has been live?
I mean, I was joking with someone in the aftermath of the media parties thing, which just like riled everyone in the industry up. And I was just like, you know, I just really thought we were all like more mentally resilient than this. You know? I have a very like normal friend who doesn't work in the industry. And she's like, oh, I've been loving reading these. You know, I just think I read it and then I think, do I agree? Do I not agree? And then I move on with my day.
Yeah.
And I was like, a normal reaction. I forgot. That's normal people. This industry, it's like, this is wrong and I must be heard.
Delia Kai is the editor of Hate Read and D's Links. She was in Brooklyn. Nico Stratos is a freelance culture critic, and she writes the newsletter Anxiety Shark from Toronto. Okay, just hang on. Commotion will be back in just a moment.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right, we're back. My name is Alameen Abdul Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. There is a distributor that acts as a middleman to bring books from publishers to sellers and then to you, the reader. In the U.S., there are very few independent distributors left. One of the longest-running small press distribution, or SPD, just folded very suddenly after 55 years in operation. Here's why this is a big deal. SPD supported more than 400 small publishers across the U.S. Some of those publishers are now owed money by SPD, like a lot of money. Black Lawrence Press is one of those publishers. Its executive director told Literary Hub, quote, "The small press world is about to fall apart." Jane Friedman is the editor of The Hot Sheet. It is a newsletter about the publishing industry. She's also the author of The Business of Being a Writer. Jane, thank you for being here to unpack all of this.
My pleasure.
Listen, let me just start by asking your reaction. What was your reaction to the news that SPD was closing so suddenly?
Shock, because when a distributor closes, there's a really long windup or dissolution, or like people have to get their books to another place. It's
right.
It's we're talking about 300,000 books that SPD was handling.
Yeah.
Units. And so to say today we're stopping and there has been no notice. Wow. I mean, now granted, SPD was on really uncertain ground. I think everyone in the community knew that. And so I don't think anyone was surprised that it might go away. But I think it was just the suddenness that one day they were shipping out books, literally, yeah, and the next day they were like, we're done.
Yeah, usually you'd hear of some kind of wind down process. Okay, this is what's going to happen to our operation. Here's what you might expect. The idea that this would kind of come on suddenly. What I saw from a lot of my Twitter feed was just like, the shock is like, can you even do that? That's quite wild. Can you just go a little bit into more detail in terms of what this means for the small publishers that they support?
Well, the most immediate problem is a logistical one. They have all of these books sitting in Ingram Warehouse, or there's another warehouse in Michigan that's holding the books. And Ingram, for its part, has said, well, you need to let us know by April 17 where you want these books to go.
Oh, my God.
In 60 days, we'll destroy them if they have not been claimed.
And Ingram is the biggest distributor in the United States, we should say. April 17th, correct. That's in a week. That's not a lot of time. Anyway. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, for a small press, I mean, keep in mind, these are typically run by volunteers, by people who have day jobs, by people who aren't doing this as something where they're sitting at their desk 24/7, you
sure.
know? So they have to drop everything. And many small presses probably never expected to be looking for another distributor. They may not know who's willing to take them. And now they have to look at, should I bring these books back to where I currently live? Can I find a distributor in time? And obviously all this costs a lot of money to ship yeah. the books, and you only want to do it once. That's the first issue they have to figure out quickly. The next issue is all of the money that may be due. So SPD owes, they paid quarterly to these presses, and they haven't made a payment for the last quarter. Mm. And at minimum, it could be going back further. It probably depends on the press when they last received a sales report or when a last payment came in. I know one press that's owed $40,000. That's Rose Metal Press. Mm. And for some of these presses, wow. that's, you know, that could be half of their annual sales, three quarters of their annual sales. And and unless they have a cushion, you know, this impacts their ability to pay author royalties,
yeah.
To continue printing books, to continue to operate.
Of course. We got maybe a couple minutes left here, so let me just ask you this. Kent Watson is executive director of SPD. He announced a closure in a statement on the company's website. He said, quote, several years of declining sales and the loss of grant support from almost every institution that annually supported SPD have combined to squeeze our budget beyond the breaking point. He seems to be alluding to some larger forces at play here. With a couple of minutes left, what do you think he's referring to?
Well, I mean, he's correct that it's a challenging environment to get arts funding, at least in the United States. All arts organizations face this challenge. I don't think SPD was, you know, well, let me back up and say SPD faced some criticism for labor conditions. Hmm. And this is going back to 2020. And I'm not sure it ever really recovered from the criticism. It may be that funders in its state or in its region did not want to fund them any longer.
Right.
So that may have been playing a role.
Yeah.
But SPD also just completed this enormous transition of its inventory to a new warehouse. So it was in the process of moving. And as we all know, moving ends up costing more than maybe you anticipated. So it was probably a confluence of factors that led to the abruptness.
Look, this is a distributor that handles books from very small presses. They publish a lot of poetry, a lot of experimental literary fiction by new voices. What do you think we lose when a place like small press distribution disappears?
We need small presses to take risks. I mean, the really big five or the big conglomerates are not taking risks on this level. They're also not necessarily looking for emerging voices. Hmm. You'll find some well-known authors coming out of SPD presses like Nell Zink or Sherman Alexie, Patricia Lockwood, whose poetry titles or their early career titles are from some of these presses.
Yeah.
So, you know, they really preserve the arts and culture.
Do you think when you think about the publishing industry and how it thinks about small presses, are there a lot of protections for small presses, or does this kind of expose us to the reality that actually they're not very well protected at all?
They're not well protected at all. So they do have another organization that's helping them currently called the Community of Literary Magazines and Small Presses.
Yeah.
And so we're hoping that support is going to get them through this rough patch.
Well, I really appreciate you being here, Jane. I am so interested in this story because the reaction that I saw to it was quite, you know, significant. And I don't think I'd been hearing from a lot of people about like the way that small presses have been affecting their lives. And then you lose small press distribution, and then suddenly there's so much interest, there's so much panic, I guess, right. as a reaction. And we learn how important they are in the ecosystem, right?
Yes. I mean, they're fundamental for the arts, for poetry, for literary fiction, for things that are not commercial enough for a big publisher to take on.
For sure. Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Of course. Jane Friedman is the editor of The Hot Sheet. It is a newsletter about the publishing industry. She's also the author of The Business of Being a Writer. We reached her in Cincinnati, Ohio. That is it for the podcast today. Also, I don't know if you know this, but we've been trying to experiment with putting some more stuff up on our YouTube. You can find us on the CBC Podcast YouTube page. For example, we've been airing our Friday group chats live directly to YouTube, so I highly recommend you check those out. We are on Instagram, if you got the time for that. We are at @commotionCBC. My name is Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. Hey, I'm going to be back tomorrow. I hope you're going to be here because I enjoy doing this. I enjoy hanging out with you. I hope to see you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.